We're going to call the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight to order. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd. First on the agenda is House File 2463, Representative Ward. The chair moves that House File 2463 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Ward, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about House File 2463, or what is also known as Joey's Law. I was supposed to have another testifier with me today from the 24-7 Sobriety Project out of South Dakota, but Mr. Mickelson couldn't make it, so members, you get me today. I'm sorry for that, but I'll do my best to present this bill to you. As I said, this House File, which is also known as Joey's Law, is being introduced to hopefully make our roads a safer place for all of us while driving, and while also attempting to change the behavior of repeat DWI offenders. You know, I just want to take a minute, members, to share with you a little bit about Joey Jordan, the young man that I crafted this language after. For it was Joey that this legislation was crafted after. Joey was a young boy entering his senior year of high school. He had spent the summer preparing himself to claim the starting position as a starting tackle on his Pequot Lakes High School football team. Yeah, that all changed one night when Joey was hit head-on by a multiple repeat drunk driving offender who had just been released from a previous conviction not much before the terrible accident took Joey's life. The drunk driver repeat offender was playing chicken with a vehicle that his mother let him illegally drive to show the young woman in his car how tough he was. That selfish act ended Joey's life, changed Joey's family forever, and motivated me to try to make our roads safer for all of us. I have introduced a number of bills, members, to address this issue in the past, but none have shown the promise that the what's known as the South Dakota 24/7 Sobriety Project does. The House File 2463 is modeled after that. And members, I know I just passed a letter out to you. I just received this before I came down from Bill Mickelson. They were just this prestigious program out of South Dakota and other states that are trying to do this as well. Just received an award from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that they're going to receive in April. They were one of the 8 national winners of the Council of State Governments Innovation Award recently. And then they also received the prestigious John P. McGovern Award for Innovation Drug Abuse Prevention for Institute of Behavior and Health in Washington in 2009. Well, I know, members, that we are moving forward statewide with the Interlock Ignition Program. I feel that the 24/7 Sobriety Program that I'm implemented this legislation after gives us another tool, another necessary tool in the toolbox to deal with repeat offenders. I believe that that House File 2463 does it at a cheaper cost and have better results than other tools that are in the toolbox. Let me give you some highlights of the program, members, if I might, please. The 24/7 Sobriety Project, which is what this House File is crafted after, is a court-based management program originally designed for repeat driving under the influence offenders. The 24/7 Sobriety Project sets the standard of no use of alcohol and no use of illegal drugs as a condition of continuing to drive and remaining in the community rather than being incarcerated. This standard is enforced by intensive monitoring by law enforcement agencies with alcohol and drug testing mandated for each participant. Violation of program rules leads to immediate and usually brief incarceration of the offender. This combination of a strictly monitored no-use standard with swift, certain, and meaningful, but usually not severe consequences has been extremely successful in the states that have implemented this program, South Dakota, North Dakota, and others that are looking at it. The 24/7 Sobriety Program reduces recidivism, it improves public safety, it serves as an alternate to incarceration that reduces the number of people in local jails and state prisons, it allows offenders to remain in the community with their family and friends, it permits offenders to maintain employment, and it saves tax dollars because most monitoring cost members are paid by the offender and because offenders are being diverted from jail and prison where appropriate. Participants in 24/7 Sobriety Project have been arrested for DWI offenses on multiple occasions. The program utilizes a variety of mechanisms to ensure abstinence from alcohol and other drugs, including twice daily breath testing for alcohol, scram bracelets, and continue monitor wearers for alcohol consumption, farm chem drug patches that collect sweat samples for laboratory stress testing, and random urine testing for drugs. Offenders are given breath and urine tests at their local sheriff's office. If they test positive, they are taken into custody immediately and are brought to court within 24 hours. Judges typically give them escalating jail terms. A first violation typically results in incarceration of one or more nights in jail. Repeat violations of no-use standard or missing test appointments lead to increased periods of incarceration and the revocation of any pretrial release. All sanctioning is swift and certain. Just a few more things, members, before I conclude my dialogue with you today and testimony today. The program results are very impressive, particularly given the fact that almost half the participants have been convicted three or more times for DUI offenses. As of February of 2010, over 13,000 offenders participated in twice daily alcohol breath testing. They took over 27 million tests and passed 99.6% of them. Over 66% of the offenders were totally compliant during their entire term of their participation. As of February 2010, 2,000 offenders wore the scram bracelet. Approximately 75% were totally compliant. Over 95% were totally compliant or violated one or two times. The daily compliance rate was 95.5%. 40 offenders wore drug patches, passing 92.8% of the tests. Over 1,000 offenders took urine tests, passing 97.6% of the tests. In addition, the large majority of participants who were surveyed about the program indicated that the program helped them stop using substances, improve their family functioning, and help them maintain or improve their employment. While early skeptics of the 24/7 sobriety model predicted that close monitoring with a strict no-use standard would fill the jails with offenders, the result of the program has been exactly the opposite. The program has reduced incarceration, leading to reduction in jail populations and jail costs. The 24/7 Sobriety Project is not just saving lives, it is reducing DUI recidivism and saving tax dollars. The 24/7 Sobriety Project model holds the promise of reducing the serious problems caused by alcohol and other drug use while making substance abuse treatment in the criminal justice system far more successful in promoting both public safety and public health than they are today. Members, I have received numerous letters and emails of support from a broad base of people, including judges, treatment professionals, members of the law enforcement community, and much, much more. One of the letters that I received from a constituent is in your packet. I believe that this gentleman who had an offense, had three offenses earlier in his life, and then had an offense recently, but between those 13 years of when he was completely compliant, I believe he would have been a total fit, perfect fit for this program, but did not really qualify for the interlock ignition program. Yet, it's another tool for repeat offenders that we can have in the toolbox. The bill, members, the House File 2463, allows for a pilot program to be run in Crow Wing County, much like the interlock program was run as a pilot program before he went statewide. My county sheriff's name is Todd Dahl. He's the Crow Wing County Sheriff. And while he has concerns, like all sheriffs do right now, based on budgeting and funding and sustainability of a new program, Sheriff Dahl is very enthused about the potential of this program and in our county. And our county, members, Crow Wing County has the third deadliest county for impaired driving in the state. This program, I believe, members, will help us reduce related DUI deaths, injuries, property damage, and accidents in the county that I represent. Members, I ask for your support for House File 2463, Joey's Law, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have, although I may have to refer to Bill Mickelson and get you the answer at a later date. Thank you for your attention, and I ask for your support for what I think is another tool in the toolbox that we need to address our repeat offenders with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, I know this is not a finance committee, but I'm sure this is going to be costs, and you mentioned something about your sheriff concerned about costs. Where does the Commissioner of Public Safety, have you had any communication with him in regards to can they implement this and make this work along with your local authorities as far as cost?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson. That's a great question, and thank you for bringing that up. Here's what happened in the states that have implemented this. I believe this is a revenue neutral bill, although there are costs, and it's because the offenders pay the testing costs, and anything that's recouped from that goes right back into the program for the operation of the program. And also, there are what happened in South Dakota is Anheuser-Busch and the National Highway Safety Traffic Association. Both of those organizations presented state grants as a pilot to implement this program. And Bill Mickelson, I keep referring to Bill Mickelson, and I wish he were here so you could meet him and hear from him as well. But he is also kind of the CEO of this project, and we are going to go after state grants from both Anheuser-Busch or any other organization that we feel will be helpful for us, along with the National Highway Traffic Safety Association. So we are hopeful that this will, the pilot will be revenue neutral on itself, and then sustainable as we because the repeat offenders pay the testing for themselves. But now I have an answer. I have not talked to Commissioner Campion about this.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 2463 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 2978 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill does, it takes a felony conviction from another state and makes it applicable in Minnesota that fits all the Minnesota statutes.
If I could get you to speak into the microphone a little bit.
Is that better?
Better. Could we get the page to turn up the volume, please? That'd be great.
What this bill does is takes a felony from another state and allows us to use it. From another state and allows us to use it to enhance penalties if it conforms to all Minnesota statutes. And I have Steve Simon. He may look like a different Steve Simon to some of you, but he's from the University of Minnesota Law School.
Welcome, Mr. Simon. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Representative Chairman Hillstrom and members of the committee, my name is Steve Simon. I'm a member of the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm also the director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force. And the task force has recommended this. Prosecutors have contacted us and have said that the Minnesota's DWI law basically says that once you're convicted of a felony DWI in Minnesota, any subsequent DWIs will always be a felony. But the current law says only if you've been convicted of a felony in Minnesota, felony DWI. And what the prosecutors are asking for is that the typical situation would be the most frequent, would be somebody who has lots of DWIs in Wisconsin, and they get to the point of having a felony DWI in Wisconsin, then come to Minnesota, and they cannot be prosecuted for felony DWI in Minnesota because their felony DWI was in Wisconsin. So the limitation of the law is that other states' laws have to be in conformity with ours. That's a protection so that somebody's not swept in for something that wasn't basically be a felony in Minnesota.
Thank you. Mr. Simon, you stated that the DWI Task Force supported this. If you could tell the group who the DWI Task Force is, who the members are, who's eligible to vote on that, that would be helpful for the members. Mr. Simon.
Madam Chair, the DWI Task Force was created in 1982. I created it, and it is made up of prosecutors, police officers, judges, probation officers, people from the Department of Public Safety, defense attorneys. We try to have a representation from the entire spectrum of the criminal justice system. Those people, they come to us and they bring us, they deal with the DWI law on a daily basis, and they bring to us the problems they have, the gaps, and things that need to be clarified. We then discuss them and take a vote on them. And anybody who's a member of the criminal justice system or a safety advocate can be a member of the task force. We typically have about 20 people attending our meetings. As I said, we've been meeting since 1982. Also, I do, in relation to many of the recommendations of the task force and many of Minnesota's DWI laws, I try to do empirical research to see, does this law work or does this law doesn't work? And I've done that over the years. But in any event, the prosecutors came to us on this particular bill. We feel it's only a small number of people, but it's a justice type of issue.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Rosenthal renews his motion that House File 2978 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 2979 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. What this bill does, it lowers the concentration from 2.0 to 1.6 as an aggravated factor in a DWI law. Basically, what happened when we lowered the limit from 0.1 to 0.08, we didn't correspondingly lower the aggravating number from 0.20 to 1.6. So originally it had been 1.0 was the limit, and then to enhance it, it had to be 2.0. So what we're doing here is just making the statement that we think it should be double as it originally was. So we want to drop it from the 0.20 to 0.16.
Questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rosenthal, I don't think you were around when
get my hair.
This particular squabble went down in the House with that conference committee. I believe it was Steve Strand, who was the chair of the conference in the House, and he's good former senator from Minneapolis, who was the chair in the Senate. This, of course, was because the feds were going to withhold highway funds from us, so why we dropped it to 0.08. So did I miss something, and we're going to lose highway funds again now if we don't drop it from 0.20 to 0.16? Because that was really the only reason why that passed through here.
Representative Rosenthal or Mr. Simon, who would like that?
I don't believe that we'll lose highway funds. The feds recommend that states adopt enhanced penalties for high BACs, but I don't believe that will. People from OTS, our Department of Public Safety, could testify in that regard.
Okay.
But there are other reasons for lowering the reading, Representative Lesh.
Representative Lesh.
I'm all yours, Madam Chair. Professor Simon.
Professor Simon.
The average alcohol concentration of somebody arrested for DWI is 0.16. The responsible drinker could not get to 0.16. They would be vomiting at about a 0.10. People at a 0.16 have been doing a lot of drinking on a regular basis. They're drinking 6, 7, 8 drinks to develop the tolerance to do that. That lower number accurately reflects people who have a serious problem with not the use, not the responsible use, but the abuse of alcohol. A responsible drinker doesn't get to a 0.16. You have to do a lot of drinking, and when you're doing a lot of drinking, you develop tolerance, but you're also a much higher risk of having a crash.
Well, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I recognize that, Professor Simon. I have no idea if I've ever been at a 0.16 or not. I doubt it, seriously. But I guess that being the case, I think we're still at the case, if someone can correct me, where we're at 1 in 8 Minnesotans who have a DWI. And if, in fact, the average is 0.16 or 0.15, I can't remember what you said. The point of having the first one be a misdemeanor is to be a wake-up call. And if, in fact, the average person now were just going to automatically make it a gross misdemeanor, that has substantial public policy ramifications that I don't know if the members of this body appreciate, especially considering the difficulty we went through in dropping it to 0.08 in the first place for the misdemeanor, and that was sold to most people on the basis that we were going to lose federal highway funds. So those are my concerns, Professor Simon.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a very reluctant supporter of the move to 0.08, and I guess my question, Professor Simon, is since Minnesota went to 0.08, have we seen measurable public safety improvements? Can you show me statistics that show that the number of crashes with people having a blood alcohol level above 0.08 is less than it was before we passed this or greater? What do the actual statistics bear out in terms of the public safety implications of going from 0.10 to 0.08?
Mr. Simon.
Madam Chair and Representative Coral, it's difficult to tease this out, but there's a couple of statistics that are relevant. One is the decrease in the number of fatalities. Now, there's many things that contribute to that, but one of the things that the 0.08 law tells people is that you should drink a little less. And when people start drinking a little less, there'll be fewer crashes. Responsible drinking is one drink an hour. Anything more than that, and you get impaired. And the 0.08 law basically is telling people you should drink a little less. And we are seeing, as we said, we've seen over the last few years a gradual lowering of the fatalities. We see we have plateaued, but there's no one silver bullet. It's a complicated area, and many of the things that we do, we need to do in order to have the total effect of controlling DWI.
Representative Coles?
Madam Chair, I tend to agree with at least some of the concerns being raised by Representative Lesch. I don't presume to know where he might be on this particular issue, but this to some extent seems like kind of nipping around the edges. I mean, if we're really going to take care of public safety in regard to DWI, let's do it. I'm not sure that this is it. And there's a huge expense both to the state with doing this, and there's collateral consequences to a lot of individuals who maybe made a really bad decision once. And unless I can be convinced that we're going to dramatically increase public safety by making this change, I'm not sure that it's something that I'm ready to support right now.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, just a few thoughts here. First of all, what we call the first one, I think people on this panel know that a first one isn't really a first one. Statistics show that somebody that gets caught the first one, that might be the first time they get caught, but they get by with it numerous times before they eventually get caught. So first one is really a bad name for this situation. Second, I see this as a great opportunity. Rather than be paid hired guns that had to be given millions of dollars to vote for something that was in the good of the state and save lives, now we can just do it in good conscience because we want to. We don't have to be paid. And thirdly, it's if we really wanted to get tough about DWIs, I agree, then we would make it a felony in the first time like they do in some other countries. They don't ever let you drive again. But I know from my experience, since we lowered it to 0.08, people have gotten a lot fussier about driving home. We've got more cab rides in town, and we've got more people watching us when we go down Main Street in the squad car wondering where we're at. I think it made people a lot more wary of driving, and I think that's a good thing.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Professor Simon. By lowering the rate from 0.2 to 0.16, is there any estimate of how many more people would fall into that category?
Madam Chair and Representative Szymanski, a rough calculation would be probably about an additional 7,500 people would be charged with the enhanced penalty gross misdemeanor. And we recognize that there will be a fiscal cost here to the courts, and it's a question of cost-benefit.
Representative Schmansky.
Just for clarification, would that be 7,500 per year?
Of the people, it will not increase the number of people arrested, but of the people that are arrested now and that are charged with the misdemeanor DWI, of those, 7,500 who were charged with a misdemeanor would then be charged under this lowering, 7,500 would be charged with a gross misdemeanor.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Simon, has the average blood alcohol concentration of a person arrested for DWI changed, or I'm assuming has it dropped at all since we moved to 0.08?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't believe it has.
Thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I assume that you've requested a fiscal note on both of your bills.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar. I was made aware that I need to do that a couple days ago, and yes.
Good idea. Thanks.
Representative Cole.
Well, Madam Chair, and I'm trying to remember the correct process for this. I don't think it happens automatically, but I think, or maybe it does, there should probably be a local impact note for this as well, because we're talking about a gross misdemeanor, which presumably is county jail time, not state prison time, so it'll be a state cost with regard to the courts potentially and public defenders. But I would suspect there'd be a county cost related to jail time. So is that, how's that work?
Representative Coles, I believe that the chair of the tax committee can ask for a local impact note, as well as maybe the lead Republican as well. So anyone can make the request of them to ask for one.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Rosenthal renews his motion that House File 2979 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Sorry, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Kaff? Representative Kaff moves that House File 2881 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Kaff.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill that I have before you today just expands the list of persons who are authorized to take blood samples for DWIs. And really what it is it's trying to just provide the opportunity to name other qualified persons, as there are many medical facilities who do not have a named individual that is currently in statute employed or working at that point in time when they may need the blood sample taken. And so I have Professor Steve Simon here with me, who can give a little bit of background on that as well.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is another issue that was brought to the task force by police officers and prosecutors, where an officer will arrest somebody and request a blood test, take them to a hospital. There are people there who are medically trained to draw a blood sample, but they don't fit the current qualifications in our DWI law to draw a forensic blood sample. I have David Brody, he's a prosecutor from Coon Rapids, who's dealt with this problem with the hospital in Anoka, and he can quickly tell you the problem and the solution that this bill does.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
David Brody, Madam Chair, fellow committee members, my name is David Brody. I'm a prosecutor in Anoka County. I've been up there for 15 years. I've been the last 5 years the assistant county city attorney in Coon Rapids, member of the DWI task force that Steve Simon just referenced. And where we've seen this issue, and at this point it appears to be somewhat of a local issue, although I can certainly see it expanding statewide, is we've got two hospitals in Anoka County, both run by Allina, Mercy, and Unity Hospitals. And the issue arises is that there's a list, as you can see from the statute, of people that can draw blood. Those are titles, and they don't necessarily have any statutory or legal definition, and so hospitals sometimes define their employees differently based on union contracts, based on their training. And what we've had and what we've seen in Anoka County recently is that their staff, especially on a Saturday night, doesn't necessarily match up with that list. The individuals that draw the blood certainly are qualified to draw blood. They're trained by the hospitals. They're trained to to specifically do that task, and a lot of times they even may be better suited to do that than those that are listed on the list. Often you'll hear that a nurse may be available or she's somewhere else but hasn't drawn blood in a while because that's generally not her duty. Generally it would be the duty then of the ER tech or an EMT. And again, I think those are kind of the couple of titles at Mercy that have been used but don't fit into the statutory definition. So this bill simply provides a catch-all provision that would allow those who are trained by a hospital to draw blood under the statute. Under 169A, and it does have an impact on us because we've always had a good relationship, our law enforcement, with the area hospitals. When we bring in individuals for this purpose, we don't get they're cooperative with us. They pull out an employee. There's no charge to the city or to the county or anybody else for drawing that blood under the implied consent procedure. However, like I said, we want to maintain that relationship. We don't want to jeopardize that. It's a public safety issue. Obviously, we do have some difficulty in court where we have had occasion where somebody that's not on that list has, in fact, drawn blood, and so we have litigated that. We do. The city of Coon Rapids currently has a case before the Court of Appeals on this very issue. Certainly, I think it still provides, and some concern may be, well, for the defendant themselves who's being drawn the blood. This obviously does provide some safety for that or some protection there, and that they do obviously have to be qualified. They do have to be trained by their hospital. And so obviously if the hospital, we believe, allows them to draw blood, then they should be able to safely do that without any issues. So again, we believe it's just a simple change to the statute. It isn't going to cost anything that we can see, and it certainly has a benefit that would be beneficial to all the parties involved, including the defendant, who's not going to have to sit around and wait while we try to find somebody that would fit in the statute.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Kath renews his motion that House File 2881 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kath.
Thank you.
Representative Bigham. Representative Bigham moves that House File 3106 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This House File 3106 is a governor's initiative through the Department of Public Safety that I am kindly caring for them. And I do have an amendment, an A2 amendment, that would get the bill in the shape that I would like to present the bill in, Madam Chair.
Okay, the author moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bigham.
Thank you. Madam Chair, with me today is Public Safety Commissioner Michael Campion, and I know we have some other testifiers that will explain the bill, but I will just turn it over to the department.
Welcome, Commissioner Campion. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. It's an honor to be here. Thank Madam Chair and members of the committee for the past support of traffic safety issues and legislation. It's made a tremendous difference over the last number of years in Minnesota. This bill is a high priority for the Department of Public Safety, and it's also a high priority for the Governor's Office. This bill is a whole new comprehensive review of administrative DWI enforcement. We think it's a very smart bill. It leverages the most current technology, and we think that it's a very good piece of legislation. This bill is the result of 62 stakeholders working over a year and a half with one very clear goal, and that is to create administrative sanctions that will decrease alcohol-related fatalities and injuries and also increase legal driving. So there's twofold goal there, Madam Chair and members. The bill requires ignition interlock to be installed on all DWI offenders for a period of 6 months for the first time with an alcohol concentration level of 0.15 to 6 years for the fifth or more conviction for a DWI offender. Ignition interlock is a tool that has effectively reduced impaired driving while installed on vehicles. This technology really should be embraced, and drivers have demonstrated behavior that demonstrates behavior that risks everyone's life on their own. The requirement does include first-time DWI offenders. The reason for this is that 80% of drinking drivers involved in a fatal crash when arrested for DWI had no DWI or only had one previous DWI conviction. Ignoring first-time offenders, therefore, would greatly decrease the effectiveness of this legislation. This legislation provides a pathway for all DWI offenders to be legal drivers within 15 to 30 days. Currently, Madam Chair, members, we have an epidemic of illegal drivers with some 40,000 convictions in the state of Minnesota every year. This is a good bill for public safety, for our roadways, and for legal driver, and for an opportunity for legal driving with four DWI offenders. It is a bill, I believe, that has wide support on a number of different issues, and thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Bingham, there was the A4 amendment that was brought to me earlier that was not, that did not meet the 24-hour rule, but it was an issue with the League of Minnesota Cities. Do you intend to offer that amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it, or do you not like it? Representative Bingham?
Madam Chair, at this time I would not like to offer it until I have an additional time to talk with the stakeholders to get clarification on it.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any further testifiers, Representative Bingham?
Madam Chair, yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jared Jordahl, the Legislative Director for the Department of Public Safety. What we have here for you is something that we are very, very excited about. As the Commissioner said, this is a proposal that's been over 18 months in the making. We sat down with a great array of stakeholders across many disciplines, Department of Health, Rehabilitation, County Prosecutors, County Attorneys, Public Defenders. We really wanted a lot of buy-in on how best to proceed in terms of an administrative sanctions initiative. And this work is the culmination of all those efforts. This is an administrative sanctions a bill. There is a great deal of confusion surrounding DWI. There's a criminal side, of course, and a civil side. This has to do with administrative license sanctions. The basis for administrative sanctions is that the commissioner is tasked in statute with issuing driver's licenses and pulling them back when an offender shows themselves to be a danger on the roadway. And those are the basis for our administrative sanctions. Administrative sanctions, of course, are geared toward rehabilitating the conduct of the offender and thereby safeguarding the roads. And the basis is that the licenses are issued through the department. You have three letters of support from different stakeholder groups, one from Mothers Against Drunk Driving in your packet, one from Minnesotans for Safer Driving, and one from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who are in support of this proposal. The Star Tribune wrote a favorable editorial in early March, and as has been said, this is the governor's initiative, and the governor has done a press conference on this proposal. What we were getting at, as was also said, is, you know, we've had a good deal of success in terms of reducing traffic fatalities. To a degree, alcohol-related fatalities have plateaued, and we wanted to make a difference, and we wanted to see what we could explore in terms of administrative sanctions to bring about positive change with affecting impaired driving behavior. I'm going off the summary of the bill. If you turn to the second page, the goals of our legislative proposal: we safeguard public safety by strengthening DWI sanctions and more effectively using technology. The technology is Interlock. It's a proven it's a proven technology at this point. 46 states have some manner of Interlock program, at least a pilot. Minnesota has had a formal Interlock program since 2007. It started out as a pilot project in two counties, Beltrami and Hennepin. Last session, it was passed to be a statewide project, and we feel that Interlock is a proven technology.
Sorry, Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I just have a question on the Interlock.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Jordahl, so I remember the pilot program. I think Mr. Mueller, you might have actually had that bill, but I'm not quite sure about how that whole thing works. So let me just see if I understand this correctly. What you're proposing is that So any person convicted of a DWI then would be required to use the ignition interlock. Would that be correct?
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer. The proposal is that revocation periods, license revocation periods, are extended for all DWI offenders, whether it's your first-time offense or your 15th offense. But we will give you full driving privileges as quickly as possible, provided you agree to accept the administrative sanction of going on the state's ignition interlock program.
I asked this, yes or no, whether it's sufficient, I think. But let me just ask you how this would work then. Let's say I have the family car and my 18-year-old child is living with me and gets a DWI or someone in my household. Does that mean that everyone in the family then is required to use the blow into the, I assume you blow into something to get your blood alcohol level determined. So that means that for however long I'm required to do, the whole household is basically punished for this behavior by one individual. I assume that's correct.
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymer, under the proposal, we expect a person subject to an interlock restriction on their driver's license is to put interlock on any car they intend to drive. We've had the question of what if you own multiple cars or whatever. It could be a case where,
Simply yes or no, Madam Chair. Just ask me. If I have one car and a family member uses it, gets a DWI, the whole family then is subject to using the ignition interlock. Yes or no?
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, that would be correct so long as the offender is going to use that car.
Thank you.
Mr. Jordahl.
The second bullet, this proposal provides a means for DWI offenders to drive with a valid license. This is one of the premier aspects of this proposal. There were 40,000 convictions last year for driving without a valid license. It's a relative epidemic. This proposal, taken in total, is a pathway to allow offenders to drive with a valid license. So we believe that this will substantially make a dent into the current epidemic we have in the state, and it's really a vicious cycle of people who don't reinstate and drive without a valid license, are caught doing so repeatedly. This provides a framework for offenders who are willing to go into the program and abide by the rules to get full driving privileges and have a valid license. That is a premier point of this proposal.
Question?
Yes.
Questions from Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordahl, I talked with some people outside the House chamber yesterday, and let me say, first of all, I think interlock is a good technology, and it's come along whether we like it or not, and it's going to be increasing in use just because it's I think it'll be effective and worthwhile for those who can afford it anyway. But I was told that, and your statistic of 40,000 a year, I'm very familiar with the pain of having to deal with convictions over and over of people who are driving without a valid license, and I'm interested in finding a way that we can increase or decrease the number of individuals that are convicted of driving without a valid license. That said, we're extending the period of time where your license is going to be revoked on this, and you say, well, it balances out with the ignition interlock, again, if you can afford it. My first question relates to what I was told outside the House chamber, that this even applies to those whose licenses are canceled as inimical to public safety due to multiple violations. And I couldn't find that in the bill. Is that true?
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, that is true.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
And I think that's a good aspect of it, because in 10 years I've found two guys who actually got their license back after they were canceled in the public safety. Maybe that's a skewed statistic, but it's what I've seen. Mr. Jordahl, how is it that, and I prosecute in a jurisdiction in St. Paul, and I'm sure that probably individuals who work in Minneapolis would
testify the same way, that we prosecute a lot of poor people. How is it that the average individual that I prosecute for DWI is going to be able to afford this, even with it reduced to $50 a month?
Mr. Jerdahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, the issue has come up repeatedly, of course. We've always been asked, the public defender has asked repeatedly in the DL sanctions work group as well, what are we going to do about indigent offenders? Under the provisions of the bill, the Department of Public Safety will certify vendors to provide interlock across the state. And in that certification process, we will say, you know, where you are required to provide geographic distribution, and we intend to say that part of the certification process, you must agree to take business from indigent offenders, and we will be capping the amount you can charge those offenders. And the estimate is about $50 is what they would be left to pay. In terms of how they would pay the $50, that's the extent to which we could reduce the cost.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Mr. Jerdahl, I understand that. This is part of the problem, I think, where we start outsourcing the core function of government, being public safety. And we do this across the board. I've carried bills that have done this, that have outsourced public safety in our driver's license reinstatement program in St. Paul, bad check diversion program we have in St. Paul. We outsource it to separate for-profit entities whose job it is to take care of this for government and say, oh, by the way, you have to take indigent people as well. I don't know how well that works out, and I have substantial concerns. That's probably my main concern with respect to this. With us extending the periods, I'm not completely convinced that we're actually going to reduce the number of people who are driving on the road without licenses if we're extending the period of time. Do you have any statistics that suggest that will happen in Minnesota, Mr. Jerdahl?
Mr. Jerdahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't have any precise statistics, no. What I can tell you is that in meeting with many legislators, and as the legislative liaison, I get many of these requests from legislators saying, I have a constituent who has a real problem. He's got his fourth DWI. He's going to lose his job. He'll do anything to drive legally. Is there a way we can do it? That was a big part. Hearing that message is a big part of how we tried to craft this as a pathway to legal driving. I can also say with the indigent funding that currently the statewide program has 700 participants approximately. And what I have heard is that almost none of them are claiming indigency. They are so grateful for the opportunity to drive validly with a valid license that they in some manner prioritize and are able to come up with the typical full price of monitoring of about $100 a month. That's certainly not to say that there aren't truly indigent offenders who will face hardship from this. We thought this was the best compromise in terms of the pricing.
Okay. Representative Lesh, and then Representative Cornish, and then Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jerdahl, this isn't your department, but I'm curious because the state public defender is in here, once in a while claiming that they serve about 70% of the statewide caseload of criminal defendants. Of course, they're all indigent, or as Mr. Kyer testified, the overwhelming majority are indigent. I don't really know what that means in terms of translating percentages, but regardless, that's a high number of people who are going to be indigent and not be able to do this. That includes $50 a month, too, because God forbid we charge anyone for free legal services as well, to which they're entitled. But I don't know how that jibes, and if in fact that's an accurate number, government is paying for us coming and going around here. Was that taken into consideration when you figured the $50 fee and how that fund is established in order to take care of the individual indigent defendants, the statistic of 70% of the statewide caseload?
Mr. Jerdahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, we did do some crunching of numbers in coming up what at you know what the market price of Interlac would be and what it is a price point that we thought indigent offenders could bear, so to speak. We took into account that apparently, you know, it's just Hennepin County had very few people who took advantage of their indigent fund when it was available. And I think we at some point had some discussions figuring that roughly 10% of people seeking to go on the program might legitimately be indigent and have to be balanced out. And I believe that that's how we ratcheted down from a market price that fluctuates around $70, $80, $90 and how we could let these vendors stay in business based on a percentage that they would be capped at in their pricing at about $50.
Okay, and Madam Chair, if I could...
Last question, Representative Lesh, then we're going to go to Cornish, and then Kelly.
It won't be a question asked for response, just by way of comment. I think we're dancing around a fiction here about who's indigent and who's not and what we can really afford in the system, because absolutely, if someone is really looking to drive, because they have to, they'll find the money to do it. I would find the money to do it. I think my neighbor would find the money to do it. But in turn, an even more expensive cost is the cost of a public defender, where you know where they're underfunded and their caseloads are overburdened, and I don't know how that syncs with what we're doing here. And I don't think this is necessarily going to work if in fact we have that many people who are truly indigent. So if you can find a way to reduce that $50 and treat it honestly the way we do, at least giving free legal services for defense, I would look at this. Until that time, that's a problem for me in this bill. So I'm not supporting it.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, this idea of too much money, it's come up before, but I'm amazed they can do it for $50 a month. I think that's cheap. And the average person, like I said before, that gets caught on a DWI is a pretty hard drinker, he or she. And in one night, probably for myself, it would take me about $40 to get blottoed. And I would think that somebody was going to get caught in a DWI, they've probably already spent $30 or $40 that night, and probably each night or three nights a week. So once they get the Interlock, they're not going to be drinking so much, and the money that they save sitting at home or going to their job can easily pay for this device. So I think it's actually a good return on the investment.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordo, a lot of our talk centered around the issue of trying to remove people who are driving without a license. And the other side of it is to try and get more people off the road driving while intoxicated. So if you were to prioritize those two, what's the ultimate goal of this legislation?
Mr. Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly, this is a goal. This is a bill meant to curtail impaired driving using the administrative sanctions infrastructure that's in place within the Department of Public Safety and subject to the department. At the same time, we view it as having a very prominent ancillary benefit of addressing the epidemic of illegal driving, and specifically hearing what we frequently hear from legislators about people who regrettably have, you know, the stories are all different. In some cases, there are individuals, constituents who on a regular basis get DWIs, rack them up, and are subject to license cancellation, long revocations. And in some cases, it's people who maybe have been sober for a while and then have a relapse sort of thing. And, you know, we want to get these people and be compassionate with this proposal and recognize that it doesn't behoove the state to have these people unable to meet their job commitments and their family commitments. And it recognizes, frankly, that, you know, in terms of the epidemic of illegal driving, that these people are going to do their darndest to drive anyway, and so we should find a way to get them to do it legally.
Mr. Jordan, I just want to clarify that in this proposal you're eliminating the work permit process, correct? And so that will no longer exist, and so the only way you will be able to drive legally, even for work, is if you have ignition interlock and you can afford the $50 per month. Is that correct, Mr. Jordan?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It's $50 for indigent offender.
Otherwise, it's $100.
That's correct. But we are phasing out the issuance of limited licenses. That's correct.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordal, I guess my comments somewhat paralleled Representative Cornish's comments. I talked to an individual in my district this morning, and he's paying $77 today for the ignition interlock. And so I would expect, given the fact that if this bill passes, we're going to be seeing an expansion among the number of ignition interlock devices used in the state, a rapid expansion. We will see market forces drive that number down. Would that be your expectation as well?
Mr. Jordal.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it would be to a degree. I think other states, it somewhat varies what the price is for interlock. I don't know that it will go, I've heard interlock pricing in the mid-70s, a little higher in some. We averaged it out saying it would be about $100 per month averaged over the time you're on interlock. That's an installation fee, the monitoring fee, and the removal fee. $100 is the price that we use, but we do think that market forces and, as additional vendors come online, that clearly will have an effect in terms of the marketplace.
Further questions? All right, please continue, Mr. Jordal.
The last bullet point that we have here, promotes successful rehabilitation. One of the real beauties of interlock is it causes offenders to assess their alcohol use. We've had some rather amazing stories from our current interlock program where the interlock device will not allow the car to start if you attempt to start the car by blowing over a 0.02. And, we've heard some stories where people drank the night before and knew that certainly were rather surprised to realize they were still over a 0.02 concentration the next day. That's a big part of rehabilitation. It's getting the driver to assess their alcohol consumption as it relates to driving the car. So, in addition with rehabilitation, we have some individuals who have acknowledged that they have an alcohol problem, that they want every incentive in the tool chest, so to speak, to prompt them to stay sober, completely abstinent. The interlock device on their car provides that, since it's tracking their alcohol use, even minor alcohol use. The next page, the key components. We require DWI offenders to drive a vehicle with ignition interlock or to not drive. Like I said, there's no issuance of limited licenses. You will sit out your revocation period. You'll sit out your revocation period if you don't wish to go on interlock. The reward is if you do go on interlock, you're given full driving privileges. You're not given a limited license. You have freedom of movement. You have a valid license.
Excuse me, Mr. Jordal. Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, and for the testifier, can we go back to that successful rehabilitation? Because it doesn't jive. I'm thinking if you have something that's going to make it easy, prevent you from driving your car, it would make you less concerned about your consumption, and what you're saying is a little bit different than that. Is it actual rehabilitation, I guess, is the question I want to know.
Mr. Jordal.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, yes, we do view it definitely as an element of rehabilitation in that it is causing the offender to think about his or her alcohol consumption. Try to gauge and plan accordingly that if they need to start their car, they must, they're becoming more in tune about how fast they run up to a certain blood alcohol content and how quickly that dissipates. And it's better allowing them to assess their drinking behavior at a given occurrence.
Representative Bigham. Follow-up, Representative Mason?
That's fine, thank you.
All right. Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, Mr. Jordal, the bullet point here requires DWI offenders to drive a vehicle with ignition interlock or not to drive. Okay, I get that. I'm with you. Makes sense. So look at the bill. I do have a concern that I'll just flag now. If I am subject to the use of a interlock device, and I say to my good friend, Representative Kelly, hey, can I borrow your car? I need to go run and grab something at Walmart. Your bill would appear to make Representative Kelly, for lending his vehicle to me, guilty of a misdemeanor, whether he knows that I'm subject to the interlock or not, at least the way that the language currently reads. And so I just raised that, Representative Bigham, Mr. Jordahl, as a concern that I would have. I don't know if that's an oversight or if that's intentional on the part of the department. If it is intentional, I guess I'd like to understand why.
Mr. Jordahl.
And I'm looking specifically, Madam Chair, page 13, line 13. It's section 13, subdivision 6.
Mr. Jordahl.
I'm sorry, page 13, you said?
Page 13, line 13. It's section 13, subdivision 6.
Please talk into the microphone so we can hear you.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Page 13, line 13. It's section 13 of the bill, subdivision 6. Provides a penalty for somebody who knowingly lends their vehicle to somebody who's required to be on admission interlock.
Madam Chair and Mr.
Representative Bigham.
Mr. Jordahl can correct me if I'm wrong, but Representative Coles, I believe what happens is if I had an ignition lock and I asked you to borrow your car and I got caught, my period that I have to be on the ignition lock then is extended through the administrative process.
And
Mr.
Chair,
Jordahl.
Representative Coles, the penalties for lending a vehicle to someone you know should have an interlock restriction, or does have an interlock restriction on their driver's license, that penalty attaches for knowingly doing so.
And Representative Coles, actually that was one of the issues that the League of Minnesota Cities brought up as well, because if your employer knows that you have ignition interlock on your personal car, this would mean that they knowingly lent you a car that did not have ignition interlock. Just so you're aware, Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, I think there's an issue here. I don't think it's an issue that I'm going to spend a lot of time on today or maybe even going forward, but I'd raise it. We got to figure this out, I think, if it's going to move forward.
And Representative Bigham.
And Madam Chair, Representative Coles, there is an amendment, I think it's the A4 amendment. That's on you. That I did talk to the league about, but I just wanted to check it over with some of other people before I went ahead and offered it today. But I do intend on addressing this issue.
Members, it's not in your packet. It didn't make the 24-hour rule, and so we were gonna wait to see if the author wanted to offer it, and then she said she didn't at this point because we would have to ask everyone if you wanted to waive the 24-hour rule, anyways. Representative Bigham, or Mr. Jordahl.
The second bullet point on the page here, DWI sanctions are enhanced for first-time offenders at 0.15 alcohol concentration level rather than 0.20.
Representative Mullery,
well,
you're on the list.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask if Mariston had to go to jail, but since we're on this now, we just voted this provision down, so they're coming back with the same thing we just voted down.
Didn't we? Mr. Jordahl?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I was sort of half listening to that bill. My understanding was that was the criminal sanction, but was that that bill had to do with 0.16 for the criminal enhancement for gross misdemeanor? This would be for enhanced civil sanctions.
Representative Mullery?
No more.
All right. Representative Cornish.
Well, I was just trying to remember, Madam Chair. I thought it was, there's a peace officer in here already, but I thought it was already a crime for somebody to knowingly allow somebody to drive, an unlicensed driver to drive your car. And this one, isn't it? I'm not sure it was. But this one is pointed at lending the vehicle, but I thought it was already an offense. So it's really nothing new. If you allow somebody unlicensed to drive your car, it's already an offense. Just makes it illegal to allow somebody to avoid the interlock device by driving your car. Right. It's awful similar.
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, the provisions making it a crime to tamper or circumvent the device, those were written for the current Interlock pilot program. Mm-hmm. So we are transferring those over now that we're making the pilot program universal.
Okay.
So those currently exist under the pilot program.
All right, Mr. Jordan.
The third bullet point restructures reinstatement requirements for chronic DWI offenders. You know, like I said, we view the Interlock device as a very valuable tool to monitor alcohol consumption by the offender. And, you know, we see this as superior to existing rehabilitation requirements dealing with, like, letters character references or letters confirming attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous, this sort of thing. Those provisions certainly have their place, but we like much better the fact that Interlock can monitor quite closely a person's alcohol use while they're behind the wheel, or just before they get behind the wheel, so to speak.
I'm just going to interrupt you for just 1 second. We have this room for 18 more minutes.
Okay.
And if we don't wrap up, then we're just going to find out if we can get another room or what time we'll have to wait to meet later if you don't finish. So, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last bullet capitalizes on the successes learned from the statewide Ignition Interlock pilot program. Like I said, it started out in 2 counties. It's now statewide as of July. We have 700 participants in the program. It has been a dramatic success as far as we are concerned, and we have heard that the participants are grateful for the opportunity to drive. With the Interlock technology, we can surgically detach the driving conduct from the drinking conduct, and that is the legitimate goal of the state. The next 2 pages are a breakdown of current law. We don't have to cover this in depth, but it's a breakdown of current law versus this proposal. What I would draw your attention to is in terms of the multiple violations, like if you look under fifth time and subsequent offender, that offender is looking at a 6-year license cancellation where there's no limited license allowed whatsoever. And under this proposal, there's a 30-day period of no driving privileges. They could go on the Interlock program. I mean, that is what we see as the very dramatic good point of this proposal. It gives people hope, so to speak. We don't see it as being in the state's best interest to take these people, substantially disrupt their lives, their jobs, their family lives. You know, this stuff is what leads to the epidemic of illegal driving. I mean, you got to give a person hope. And it basically shuts them down, saying you can't drive legally for 6 years. Under our proposal, you agree to Interlock, you can be on the road within 30 days. And we're amenable to, you know, I've been asked by many legislators, how quickly can you get someone on Interlock? Our answer has always been, we'll get them as quickly on Interlock as absolutely possible. That's what we want to do. We have the technology now to get them back on the roads. The last page. Benefits of the proposal, benefits to the public, create safer roadways through the use of Ignition Interlock on high-risk drivers, more effectively protects the public than existing sanctions. You know, what do we mean by that? Well, you know, Interlock, again, controls the combination drinking and driving behavior, lets us monitor it, lets us intervene if we have a problem driver on the road, and it makes a lot more sense than the existing sanction system. Reduces societal costs associated with impaired driving, benefits to the DWI offender, creates a pathway for all offenders to obtain a valid driver's license within 15 to 30 days, encourages behavior modification and rehabilitation, benefits to the state, the offenders pay the program costs, the estimate here is $100 per month or $50 for the indigent. There's no net general fund hit here. We are able to retask some of our driver and vehicle services people by not issuing the limited licenses. We're able to retask those people who monitored that program to monitor now a statewide universal Ignition Interlock program for all of the state. And lastly, diminishes the probability and possibility of repeat DWI. For Interlock, if this Interlock proposal is adopted and becomes universal, we think that it will be much, much more rare for someone to literally be able to rack up 15 or 20 DWIs, these embarrassing political events, like we can currently have, because now we literally have something on the car that will prevent the person from starting the car when intoxicated, getting it out of their driveway where they can encounter law enforcement to be arrested for DWI. This proposal makes maximum use of technology. It's no cost to the state. The offender pays. And, you know, we think it's compassionate, yet it's tough on DWI, and we think it has a number of positive attributes, and we greatly appreciate your support.
Mr. Jordan, I have a question, actually. So if you could tell us, someone has the ignition interlock, they've already gone through this process, they now have ignition interlock, and they blow too high, their car doesn't start, is there a consequence? What happens to the person who breaks the rules? Mr. Jordan.
Madam Chair, there will be, during the period that someone, it depends on the number of offenses. For the first and second offender who has to go on interlock, and if you look at the blue sheets, they go on interlock for a first offense at 0.08. They go on interlock for 6 months. For a second offense, they go on interlock for 2 years. There's no offense for blowing, there's no penalty for blowing over the legal limit or over a 0.02 where your car won't start. There is no offense. It would be tracked and reported by the vendor to the Department of Public Safety, and so we would be aware of it, but the penalty, as it were, would be that your car would not start.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there is no penalty, why does the Department of Public Safety need to know? If the car doesn't start, and the objective is to keep people who have been drinking from being able to start their car, one, something I agree with, why does the Department of Public Safety need to know this? Why, as a policy matter, would we want the department to know that?
Mr. Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, the reason is to track, we do have some offenders on interlock who are on an absolute sobriety period. And for those individuals, we do need to know that they attempted to start the car with alcohol in their system.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordan, when you were in my office, you said that if you blew an over an 0.02 after 3 months, you entered an extended period on the interlock. You achieved an extended period to stay on the interlock. Okay. And you just said now that it doesn't matter.
But
Mr. Jordan.
I had a couple people frantically whisper the same thing in my ear, and I apologize.
Yeah.
That is correct. We want, anytime someone has a period on interlock, we want them to have the last 3 months free of alcohol-related failures. So for a first offense, you're on interlock for 6 months. If in the first 3 months you blow even repeated alcohol-related failures, there is no sanction. But in the last 3 months, we want you to have been assessing your alcohol consumption and your driving, and we don't want any alcohol-related failures. Or it's extended for 3 months.
Mr. Jordan, so if someone in my house had a DWI and got an ignition interlock, mm-hmm. and then someone else in my house used the car and happened to go out and they blew 0.03, that would count as a violation of the person who had the order of the ignition interlock, or would the data be able to show you that it was the same person who blew in violation or not? Mr. Jordan.
Well, Madam Chair, we would we do recognize that there will be situations where both the offender and non-offenders in the household or whatever will be using the car and having to use the interlock. What I could say is that we would attempt to interpret the data accordingly. So we would get a download of what happened on a given day. We would kind of, it looks like you're under a absolute sobriety period and you attempted to start your car and you were at 0.07. What happened there? And we would be receptive to, you know, that was my brother, my spouse, whatever, who attempted to start the car. That was not me.
Okay, Mr. Jordan, that brings me to another testimony that was submitted by the American Beverages Institute. They're claiming that there is an $11 million a year to enforce this. Can you explain why you think there's no fiscal cost here, Mr. Jordan?
I can, Madam Chair. I have seen that letter. I read it a couple of days ago in the other committee, but my understanding is that they're misconstruing the bill and that they are viewing this as a criminal penalty, and therefore there would be costs on probation to oversee the Interlock program through county corrections and probation, and that is the basis for the $11 million cost.
So, Mr. Jordahl, getting back to, somebody else in the car blew and you were over the limit and the department calls them and says, what happened here? And the person says, it wasn't my fault. I didn't do it. My son had my car. My wife had my car. Whoever had my car, I didn't do it. And you extend the sanctions. Is there a way for them to appeal that, or is there going to be a process for someone to challenge your determination that you're extending it, or is that kind of a unilateral decision that you'll have without the ability to challenge that, Mr. Jordahl?
Well, Madam Chair, we would not, in legitimate cases, we would try to investigate the circumstances behind the incident, and we would not arbitrarily be extending the period. We would try to do an investigation to see if it's warranted.
Well, Mr. Jordahl, the reason why I'm asking that is because I believe that every single person who has another family member is going to argue, it wasn't me, really, I swear, it wasn't me. So every single person who violates, who's going to have the opportunity to be extended, they're going to argue that it wasn't them. And so I'm curious as to how you're going to investigate and really know whether it was that person or not that person if we're not allocating any money, and everyone in the family is going to be obligated to do this.
Okay.
Mr. Jordahl.
Madam Chair, I've just been reminded that participants in the program do have, as you can imagine, some paperwork to fill out that acknowledges that they know how to properly blow into the device, what to do if they think they fear they've registered a false positive due to toothpaste or yeast-producing foodstuffs or mouthwash, this sort of stuff. They're going to be trained on how to use the Interlock. They are going to be advised on that point. You're reminded that this is not a toy. You are, this monitoring is being tracked, and accessed by unauthorized individuals could lead to positives that appearing on the record and reported to the Department of Public Safety. So we're hoping the education process on the offender will help to allay much of that.
Okay, I have Representative Lesh, Representative Mullery, and Representative Bigham.
It's to this point, Madam Chair, to your
answer. So first, yes. Bigham, then Mullery, then Lesh. Bigham.
I just, not that it wouldn't happen, Madam Chair, the story or the question you had, but I just checked with the department. They said that is not happening, or they haven't had any instances of that to date. Not that it couldn't happen. I just wanted you to know that.
All right. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I thought you were going to follow up because he totally obfuscated your question, the answer to your question. He didn't answer it at all. The fact that they're trained, you earlier said that people in the family naturally be using this. They're going to have to be trained on this Interlock system also. So saying that it only people are going to be using it that are trained on it, that doesn't answer her question even slightly. It's a total non-answer to her question. I'd like to hear the answer to her question.
I don't get his question.
Mr. Jordahl.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, question was.
Do you want to think about that one? We'll have another question.
I'm trying to think of what the original question was. I'm sorry.
Representative Mullery.
Well, Madam Chair, it's your question, but
okay.
What it was if somebody else claims that they did it, they blew with over it.
Well,
Mr. Jordahl.
What we would do is try to investigate the circumstances as much as possible. We would ask the offender, you seem to have this alcohol-related violation. Can you account for some explanation for this? If the explanation comes back that, this was my cousin or brother-in-law or friend or something, we would look into that as deeply as we can. What I was trying to most of all convey is we would not be frivolously, extending
we would be attempting to verify that what seems to be from the vendor download an alcohol-related violation is in fact a legitimate alcohol-related violation and not someone else with unauthorized access fiddling around or joking around with the interlock or trying to get the person in trouble or it's not mouthwash or something else. We had pledged to do our best job of assessing what look like alcohol violations and responding accordingly, certainly before we take, you know, sanction action without investigating.
Okay, members, we have 4 minutes left in the room, and then we either have to get a new room. We have one room available at 2:45 and one available at 6, but I know members have other committees. So if members would talk to the researchers quick and find out, I want to make sure we have the majority of members or as many members in the room as we can as we get ready to move. So if Ms. Weeks and Andy, I'm sorry, Gilday, if you could find out when your members are mostly available, we want to make sure we have as many folks in the room as possible. And there are a lot of folks from the public that came here to testify, so we want to give them the opportunity. So, Representative Driskowski. Oh, Lesh, you were next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I'm just getting more questions here as I'm sitting here listening. And members, as a prosecutor, early in my legislative career, I think I was at the council table or at the testifiers table multiple times assuring members that no, if you give prosecutors this authority, trust me, we'll be the benevolent big brother and not get out of hand and truly investigate the matter such that a person is not unjustly pinned with an adverse consequence. In this case, or in those cases, it's still up to me as the state to prove that the person is guilty, but up until that point, they're innocent. In this instance, that's not the case. They're innocent until proven guilty. That said, I'm sure there will be further discussion about this. I originally would have said maybe Representative Bingham's amendment or some of this discussion would occur in Representative Paymar's committee, but much to my chagrin, somehow this cleverly made the square policy peg jam into the round fiscal note hole again in the fiscal note shell game we play around here. There seems to be multiple reasons aside from the chair's letter of why this should have a fiscal note, not to mention the fact that we're adding costs onto a defendant that they would otherwise be using for a local impact of a bail, for example, or state costs of being unable to afford private counsel and thereby hire a public defender, which would clearly put it in the place of having a fiscal note. And many members around this table are very aware that there are some incredibly spurious reasons why bills are referred for fiscal notes. This does not seem spurious at all. It's a basic math function. So I'm wondering if maybe Representative Paymar might be interested in requesting this because of that impact.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I fully intended to. There are, if you look on page 10, there's a whole litany of things that the commissioner is required to do, establish performance standards, certify devices for the program, establish guidelines. Mr. Jordahl just said that the department will be tracking offenders who failed, investigating cases of family members to make sure that there's not an erroneous conclusion set forth by the department. If one of eight people in the state of Minnesota have DWIs, I would imagine that in time, hundreds, maybe thousands of people will be having these interlock devices on their cars. I can't imagine there wouldn't be investigatory costs involved and oversight costs involved with the department. So I don't know if there's been a fiscal note that's been required, but there should be, and I think we should explore it in more detail.
Representative Driskowski or Representative Bingham? Okay, Mr. Jordahl will answer the fiscal.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, if I may, there is no net cost. The cost to, our talking point is that the offender pays for this proposal, and we stand by that. But we do have retasking of personnel within our driver and vehicle services division, which is the transportation budget, my understanding, rather than public safety. But if you wish to draw down the bill, that is your prerogative, but the cost is to our driver and vehicle services division, which is customarily Representative Leaders Committee in terms of budgeting.
Representative Paymar?
Well, I just want to know, is there been a fiscal note done?
Representative Paymar, I don't request fiscal notes, so that's either the author or the chair of the Finance Committee.
I'd like to see one.
Okay. All right. Next on the list is Representative Druskowski, then Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'd just be looking for your direction. I want to offer the A7 amendment at some point. Maybe at this point we should wait until we reconvene.
I'm sorry, Representative Druskowski.
Should we wait till we reconvene, Madam Chair, until I offer this amendment?
Representative Druskowski, I don't know if we have all the members. I haven't received the list on when your members are available. So if you'd like to offer your amendment, you certainly can offer it. We're supposed to be done, but we can go over a little. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would offer the A7 amendment.
Representative Druskowski.
Remove the A7 amendment.
If you'd speak to what the amendment is, let the members know.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment, members, would get rid of the B-card provisions out there, and talking with the department and understanding the direction of this bill, which I definitely support the direction of the bill, it changes the focus of law enforcement around DWIs to the behavior of driving, rather than some of the administrative sanctions that we have now, that we actually find, and I hear stories of police knocking on windows of people in their house and going into the bar and to see who's in there and who's drinking in violation of the B card violation, which for members that aren't aware, the B card violation is a no alcohol consumption agreement, if you will, that people who have violated 3 times in 10 years, or help me out, Mr. Jordan, 4 times in 11 years, sign this agreement in order to get their license back. And so under this new approach, which I think is, as I can see, is a very good approach to this bill, there would virtually not be a need for the B card administrative process anymore, so this would get rid of it.
Questions from members? Representative Bigham.
The will of the committee, Madam Chair. It's kind of a department bill, so I will, whatever the will of the committee is.
Typically, I would ask for if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this part, but because we're supposed to be wrapping up, can you raise your hand so that I can see how many people would want to testify on the B card provision? There's only one, so if you...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not on the B card. Okay. So there's no one in the audience that wishes to testify on this amendment. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, Representative Druskowski moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bigham.
At this point, I think to maybe work a little bit more on some amendments, I'm hearing some concerns. So I would ask at this time that maybe you consider laying the bill over and we bring it up for a different day. Maybe next week or something, I can work with Peter.
Okay. I'm willing to lay the bill on the table. We're lay over the bill till next week. All right. The chair lays the bill over.
Thank you, member.
Thank you.